All right, this is talking with Gart Westerhout on 22nd November 73 at the Max Planck Institute in Bonn. So, how did you get involved in radio astronomy?
In essence, by, when you're a young graduate student, you don't really quite know where to go yet, so
right.
What I started out doing was working with Walraven on amplifiers for photoelectric photometry. I don't quite remember anymore why I sort of expressed an interest in radio or electronics. I fiddled with radios when I was young. And somehow or another that made them assign me to Walraven.
Mm-hmm.
Then when
you had studied as an undergraduate in astronomy,
yeah,
actually. Right. So you're one of the few, very few early radio astronomers that studied astronomy.
That's quite correct. Yeah, yeah, Hugh van Woerden is another one.
But he's not quite so early as you, yeah.
Yeah, he's a year earlier than I.
Oh, is he really?
Yeah. He got his PhD much later, but he started in 1944. He got out of high school a year before I did.
I see, I didn't realize that. Well,
then, of course, there was a year lost for me, a year lost during the war. I got out of high school in 1944. And then, of course, I lost a full year. Van Woerden got out of high school in 1943. And, in essence, lost 2 years, but did already some astronomy.
Hmm. Well, I still have to talk to him. That's why I don't know exactly when he started. Okay, so you worked with Walraven.
Yeah, and then I forget exactly when that was, but that must have been in May of 1950. Bolton and Westfold were making this trip around the world, and they were spending a long time in England. And Oort invited them over to come and give a talk. Mm. The Pantheon did it, everything together. They had published this paper shortly before on the distribution of radio emission over the sky.
Right.
Everything was so beautifully smooth. They had even deconvoluted for the antenna pattern.
Right.
So-called, which was 17 degrees, and we really believed that that was the distribution of radio emission at that particular frequency, whatever it was. I've even forgotten that.
It's 150 or 200, I think.
Something like that. They came and gave a talk, but that was actually rather interesting because there were stages where both of them were standing in front of the blackboard at the same time. I can still see that.
I see.
Jumping up and down and correcting each other or making remarks here and there. That was a very, I still remember that colloquium vividly. It was a very interesting one. And I don't quite know how it then came about, but I guess in Oort's inimitable way, he simply picked somebody and said, "Would you like to look into this particular problem?" That's how I started to look into that particular problem. I'm trying to think now whether that was... No, that all went sort of at the same time because I was also looking at around that same era at Bade's determination of the distance to the galactic center, where he looked at all the RLI variables.
Mm-hmm.
You saw, if you plotted RLI variables as a function of magnitude, was this beautiful peak, and making appropriate corrections, you could say something about the mass distribution, that governed that spherical distribution of RLI variables. Yeah. So all that came in, and I don't quite know which came first, the idea of looking at the model of making a model of the mass distribution that fitted the radio data, or the other way around.
But that was influencing anyway.
Those things were all influencing each other.
The way the final paper came out.
Well,
what I'm particularly interested in is where did the idea come from about to base it on the distribution of stars and the mass distribution of stars. That was the the fundamental thing in that paper, was it not, really?
That was the fundamental thing in that paper, and that idea came mainly from the fact that when you looked, there is a chapter in that paper on the distribution of ionized gas, and it was quite clear that the distribution of ionized gas was very much thinner than the observed distribution on the sky.
Right.
So it couldn't be the ionized gas. Moreover, you could show, or we could show, that the intensity from the ionized gas, given certain assumptions and so on, was too low.
Right.
So, although we treated that very carefully, we showed in that paper that it could not be the ionized gas. So what is it that you do the next time? You say, okay, the other constituent we know is the stars. If whatever emits that radiation has something to do with the stars, and the synchrotron theory was not really known yet. I mean, I think the Alfvén and Harrelson paper came out in 49 or 50.
50, yeah. April 50, I think.
April 50. So we certainly, when we started that work, didn't know anything about that at all. So we said, okay, let's look at something that's distributed the same way as the general matter in the galaxy and see what that gives. And adjust it a little bit here and there, and lo and behold, it sort of seemed to fit reasonably well.
Mm-hmm.
Which... I think the most interesting thing I always find in that paper is the naivete with which one thought that when you apply a Bracewell type deconvolution that you then see the true picture.
Yeah. You had all the information.
You had all the information there. I mean, that was the distribution. It wasn't until considerably later, that considerably means a few years, that we began to realize that, of course, meant absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
The side lobes had been removed, and the stuff...
You mean the great smoothness was really leading you astray, and you really thought it actually was that way, even with infinite resolution. But this paper, would you not agree, really... kept the idea of radio stars alive quite a long while. I mean, people had talked about the discrete sources as radio stars, but then when you talked about the radio distribution relative to the stellar distribution, then you really began to think of radio stars. Would you say that's fair?
No, I don't think so. Maybe in other people's minds. I think neither in Nort's mind nor in my mind did we ever think of discrete objects, of things. Well, maybe we did, because there's an analysis in that paper where you do go by luminosity, you stick in an arbitrary luminosity function and you do all sorts of things that way. Maybe you're right in that analysis, that one really did think about radio stars. We didn't. I think we were very careful not to call them stars. We were never thinking of stars.
No, you never say radio stars.
I think at most we may have talked about objects.
Yeah.
Or emitters or something like that.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Okay. Radio emitters. But we very specifically did not think of stars. That's why I was sort of hesitating there a bit.
But anyway, so you published this paper in your first couple years of graduate school then, so...
Yeah, after one year, in essence.
Yeah, that was that's quite an accomplishment.
And then while I was at it, well, this was, of course, as you may note when you look at the paper, I mean, I did the spade work, but Ort did the theory.
Yeah.
Ort did a lot of the polishing of the writing and all of that, quite obviously. I mean, it was Ort's work, and I was the young graduate student assisting in it. Well, there was a lot of looking up things and finding out everything there was to be found out in the literature up till that time and so on, including the ideas about the ionized hydrogen, what that would emit. At that same time, van der Hulst wasn't there, and we wrote that paper. He was in
Harvard.
At Harvard that year. Yeah, the other thing that I suddenly remember, I caught when I entered the observatory as a graduate student, I was stuck in a room together with the Chinese who had been constructing the 21-centimeter diameter. Ho, right. Golly.
Who was taken off
the building had just been burnt, had just burnt down. In other words, I wasn't there yet when that building burnt down.
I see.
I didn't participate in that fiasco. But he was sort of sitting there for a while, and then he more or less disappeared. And as a young graduate student, I never quite knew what happened or what didn't happen.
But what is supposed... Mueller didn't really tell me how that happened, or maybe he didn't know, but... I mean, what is supposedly what happened, how that happened? Just a...
just an accident. I mean, how does anything like that happen? I mean, it was a wooden shed in which they were constructing that material sitting beside the Würzburg.
But there were no people in it at the time.
No. No, there were no people at all. That's why it burned down to the ground.
They just came out one morning and found it.
Yeah, found it burned down. And it was sort of in the, you know, how the area around Kotwijk there is. I mean, if a shed burns there, okay, it burns. That's that. I don't know whether they actually came out one morning and saw it burn down, but it was quite obvious that I don't think it was particularly anybody's fault.
Yeah.
Although I also have always had the feeling that people like Oort and van der Hoos would be able to give you more information about that. I always had the feeling that they didn't think much of the efforts of Mr. Ho.
Yeah. Well, indeed, he wasn't getting very far,
apparently.
I mean, certainly Mueller got,
got
very fast, very quickly. Right. Yeah.
And of course, Mueller just had his engineer's diploma. They got him as a new fresh guy, and he got into it.
So it was while you were working on this this paper that the line was discovered, I guess.
I think so, yes. That must have been the same time. Yeah, because that was in 51.
Right.
I think the paper was finished at that time, or just about to be finished, putting the last touches on it. Because I was still busy working at that time with André Muller, the other Muller, assisting him in observing XE Cygni for his PhD thesis, so spending long nights at the observatory or doing photoelectric photometry.
Mm-hmm.
And I continued doing that also after the 21 centimeter line was discovered. Let me think now, the line was discovered, I think the first lightning Kotwijk detection was in May.
Right.
And I went out there almost immediately, I mean a few days later, because I was necessarily the only student who was involved in radio astronomy at that stage. So I went out there to assist in the observing, and then several other students went out. So, but I only spent a week or two there at that during that first period.
That led to the van der Holst.
Even
the very first period. I see what you're saying.
The very first period. Isn't it in this VAN here that we published that very original line profile? This one, yeah.
Yes.
The first receiver in the summer of 1951. That's what they looked like, and we went all our switching frequencies were very close together. That's why you always got that sort of a pattern when you change the frequency.
Yeah, Mueller showed me an actual strip chart was about 3 weeks after the discovery. So then when did you actually get involved in radio astronomy again then?
Yeah, I'm trying to think how that worked. Because I then, let me see, the Oort and